Either way, I'm going to start with Donald Trump. And I'm not referring to all of his legal woes, Stormy Daniels, the Georgia, was it 20,000 votes? Find me 20,000 votes. Really, what I'm referring to is the latest one, and that is related, of course, to January the 6th and the assault on the US Capitol. So the first question, I suppose, is to think back to January the 6th, 2020, and what happened. There were those who dismissed it as nothing more than a boisterous demonstration that got out of hand. I think that was foolish, not least if we look at what was happening before January the 6th, i.e., Trump's attempt to get the military more and more involved in US domestic politics, plus, of course, all the accusations after the general election in November that things had been fixed. And certainly, looking at things from where I sit now, it seems pretty clear that what was going on, and it seemed pretty clear to me at the time, I have to confess, that what was going on was no mere demonstration and a stroll up the road to the Capitol building. No, what was being attempted was to overthrow the result of the November election, because, of course, what was going on in the Capitol, presided over by Mike Pence, was the Electoral College. And the idea of Trump and his team, because we don't just have Trump up on charges, we have, what was it, five others? Maybe there will be more to follow. Either way, what they're being charged with is a conspiracy to overthrow the results of the November election. And that would have been done if Mike Pence had played along and, when it came to various state electors, had said that no, the election wasn't fair, wasn't valid in your state, I'm disallowing it. And therefore, you are left with enough Trump electors. Remember, the American election system is indirect, to allow Trump the victory. What would have happened then? Of course, I'm speculating, we don't know, and counterfactual history, is a very limited exercise. Nonetheless, my guess, for what it's worth, is that the CIA or the FBI or the army or a combination of all three and more, I don't know. But we did have General Milley, Chief of Staff, telling his subordinates, don't obey the fascists, obey me. And what he meant by the fascists was, of course, Trump, the commander in chief of the US Armed Forces, and his crew. So what would have happened to Trump under those circumstances? Maybe he would have been taken to a mental asylum, and they would have announced that, well, I'm afraid the president's gone mad and is in urgent need of treatment. Whatever it was, I'm convinced that if this coup, and I think it was a coup attempt, had succeeded, then you would have seen some sort of army stroke, as I said, state action. What then would have happened? I'm not going to go any further. I think, if we can only do it a few times before we end up in science fiction and writing a novel instead of, doing a political commentary. Nonetheless, I was convinced that it was some sort of coup attempt. It wasn't the most magnificent coup attempt that there's ever been. The very fact that it didn't come off, the very fact that Mike Pence wasn't in on it, hadn't agreed to play his role, the very fact that, you know, he had to be scuttled away, and you had demonstrators there with, you know, nooses ready to do him if he didn't do what he was told. No, it wasn't a particularly, how should I put it, well-planned coup. Nonetheless, it was a coup attempt. And how should I put it, the more intelligent sections of the left, and that's saying something, again, did downplay it, in my view, completely wrongly, by saying it wasn't a coup. Or maybe I shouldn't say the more intelligent sections of the left. Anyway, there were those sections of the left that says it wasn't a coup. It was more like the beer hall putsch, which, of course, is a German word. I think it derives from Switzerland for a coup. So in other words, this wasn't a coup. It was a coup, which is what, you know, Counterfire, John Rees, Lindsay German, and those comrades were saying. Clearly, this wasn't a classic coup from outside, you know, the immediate circles of the presidency. Quite the opposite. It was a self-coup attempt. And in that sense, you know, again, looking back at French history, this was more like Louis Napoleon and his coup that made him into the, from the president into the emperor, you know, Napoleon III and all the rest of it. And that was proclaimed through a plebiscite, a referendum, a device of the dictators, if ever there was one. Now, again, you know, I don't know enough about American politics to say whether these court cases will be successful or whether they will fail. I don't know enough about the American Constitution to say that, well, you've got, you know, freedom of speech guaranteed, and all Trump was doing on January the 6th was, you know, honestly, openly questioning the result, addressing supporters. What's wrong with that? I don't know. But on the other hand, what we have in the United States is a constitution where the president, you know, isn't subject to normal laws. That doesn't mean it if he, you know, murdered his wife or, you know, nicked a beef burger, you know, from a McDonald's, he couldn't be charged. But when it comes to the execution of his presidential responsibilities, my understanding is that the buck stops with Congress. It's Congress that decides whether he's out of line, and to decide whether he's out of line requires a supermajority, as I understand it, a two-thirds majority. And after all, the Democrats have tried to impeach him. They failed. On some occasions, some Republicans have gone with them, but clearly not enough. And I think, you know, it's at least feasible, and we need to think about this, to imagine a situation of where not only does it look like, at least from where we sit at the moment, that Trump will be the Republican candidate in the next presidential election, but it's at least conceivable that he could damn well win it. Now, I have to confess that my you know, abilities at predicting these things is pretty limited. After all, last time around, when I looked at the lineup of I don't know how many Republican candidates there were, and I looked at these misfits and weirdos, and then we came to Trump, my view was, well, there's no way the Republican establishment is going to allow this clown to stand. Well, they did. They had no choice about it. He won. He went on. And God damn it, he actually won the contest, you know, against Hillary Clinton. Who's to say he can't do it this time? you know, he's way ahead when it comes to his Republican rivals. And as far as I know, his rivals have actually rallied around him in terms of his latest legal troubles. So, at least from, as I said, from where we are at the moment, it looks like he will be the Republican candidate. Will he beat Joe Biden? It's at least conceivable. And indeed, you could have a situation, after all, they're both, you know, neither of them are spring chickens, but I could certainly imagine a Joe Biden, you know, falling down the stairs of Air Force One or completely losing his already, you know, somewhat limited grasp on his marbles. So it is quite conceivable that Trump runs. And then what happens? I mean, as far as I would understand his legal tactics, it would be to, you know, string it out as long as possible, that if it arrives at a certain conclusion, you throw in your appeal. My understanding is an awful lot of the money that's going into his presidential campaign is going out in order to pay legal fees to, you know, presumably, you know, top experts. But there you are. You could imagine a situation that come the next presidential election, here he is under trial for conspiracy to overthrow the election. He wins the election. What happens then? You know, do the equivalents of General Miley act? What do the Democrats say under those circumstances? Does Trump then go on to say, well, I've got presidential immunity? Does he, you know, when it comes to the other trials, does he squash them? Does he, use the get out of jail free card and, declare an amnesty for himself? I haven't got a clue, but we're quite clearly, you know, in a situation where there's every potentiality of the United States, walking in to one hell of a constitutional crisis, the likes of, I think it would be fair to say, that hasn't been seen since before the US Civil War, the Second Revolution, is saying something. So, you know, as I said, I haven't got a clue what will happen, but that sort of scenario is clearly not wild speculation. It's not sort of crazy speculation. It's something that's realistic. And one would have thought the political and state actors in the United States on both sides are actually thinking hard about that possibility. And, you know, quite frankly, that isn't simply a domestic question. It's something that would have profound effect on global capitalism, not least the leading elements in global capitalism, which, of course, are organized by and under the United States. So the Five Eyes, Britain, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, but also AUKUS, NATO, Japan, all of these countries, you know, are locked in to the United States. And of course, if you look, you know, at what's going on at the moment in Ukraine, a proxy war being fought by NATO, I can tell you one individual that would be longing, dreaming of a Trump victory. And of course, that's Putin. And that could be a complete game changer as far as Russia is concerned. So, you know, it really does have enormous consequences in terms of global politics. On the other hand, of course, there is the scenario of where Sleepy Joe, you know, wins convincingly, and maybe, yeah, Trump goes to jail. Who knows? Okay, just moving on. This is back to Britain, little Blighty. We have Rishi Sunak and the Tories, looking at at least the likelihood of defeat at the next general election. And Rishi Sunak came out with these five pledges that look pretty shaky. They looked shaky at me, to me at the time he made them. At least some of them looked incredibly shaky. I don't know all of the five. One of them I thought, well, that's a fair bet, but it looks pretty awful at the moment. And that is, I pledge to bring down inflation. Well, inflation has nudged down slightly, but not by much at all. And indeed, what we've got is the independent Bank of England that's just nudged up interest rates in the attempt to dampen down the economy, i.e. create more unemployment, push down on wages so that profits can be boosted. That's actually what's going on. So people pay more rent, more interest rates on their mortgages, higher prices in the shops. So in that sense, their anti-inflation medicine is, adds to inflation itself. It's not simply an anti-inflation thing. But then he had his big bright idea about, I will bring down the number of small boats bringing migrants. I always thought that was just a daft idea. Okay, his strategy to achieve that is to make things so damned unpleasant for migrants, and I'm using the word migrants deliberately, that they simply won't come. I think that's delusional. Why? Because what we have is push. People aren't coming, on the basis of, I just happen to fancy it. They're being pushed by desperation. They're being pushed in that sense by life at home is shit. And that doesn't just include the obvious countries, like Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, but it also includes countries in Europe. And I'm thinking in particular of Albania, where I guess the majority of people are not fleeing political persecution, are these so-called economic migrants. They want a better life. And what you've got in Albania is a well-organized operation to bring people over. And the idea that you lock them up, as they're doing, haven't yet done it, on some sort of giant barge parked somewhere on the south coast, the idea that people can't escape, and disappear into the black economy, well, of course they can, and of course they will. And a lot of them in the black economy will do well enough that if they do go back home, they will go back home and they will be viewed by their fellow villagers or townspeople as rich and successful. They'll go back with an ability to have a flash car, flash clothes, designer this and designer that. Anyway, the other pledge, and the only other pledge I can remember getting onto the subject, is I will bring down waiting lists. Well, I thought, well, that's a safe bet, isn't it? Because here you are, Britain, recovering from the COVID pandemic, where, hospitals were full of wheezing and, desperate people. The waiting lists are bound to go down. Well, how wrong was I? No, what's happened actually is waiting lists have gone up. That's partially because of lack of spending on the National Health Service. It's partially, yes, it would be foolish to deny it, the result of industrial action by badly paid staff. And that goes from, the lowest grades, cleaners, orderlies, right up to the very top. So if you take our so-called junior doctors, these are people who've done 5 years at university and X years working as doctors, junior needs to be done with a few quote marks there. These people have seen their real wages go down, as I understand it, since something like 2008 by a third. And what we have on a global level is a bidding war by various health services, you know, to nick other people's doctors, other people's nurses. Now, I'm in favour of the free movement of labour, but I do note that when I go to hospital, and I have been to hospital relatively recently, you'll rest assured, nothing serious. But, you know, who meets me? You know, who am I being dealt with? Well, an Eastern European technician, an Indian doctor. And I'm not talking about a British Asian doctor. I'm talking about someone who's got a medical degree from an Indian university. And there you are, there's a South African nurse. And the same is going on in Britain. So at the moment we have Australia going around Britain trying to recruit doctors. We have Canada doing the same thing. We have America as a land of opportunity for British doctors. So, you know, that is what is going on. So in Britain, we have an undersupply of medical staff. They're just not being trained. And that includes doctors, midwives, nurses, and the NHS relies on recruiting people who've been trained elsewhere. And at the same time, they are losing people to elsewhere who can pay even better wages and provide certainly less stressful conditions. So at the moment, what we've got is a sort of ideological war being conducted by the Tories and their friends against doctors, against nurses. Well, that was, you know, last week before the Royal College of Nursing settled. And so, you know, those people that were being praised throughout COVID for working, you know, and risking their lives are now being condemned as greedy and up to no good. I've even heard the British Medical Association, which isn't just a trade union, by the way, it actually regulates doctors. It decides who can be a doctor and who isn't, who's going to be struck off, who isn't allowed to practice. So it's a disciplinary institution at the same time. I've heard it even described, you know, in the right-wing media as a Marxist organization. Well, I'm sure there are some, I know there are some people in the BMA, not least in the junior doctors side of things, who describe themselves unashamedly as socialist and perhaps as Marxist. But I'm also reminded, I was just looking at the Daily Mail and its version of the class war. And it, you know, it doesn't take any sort of editor, does it? It just takes a hack, what used to be called a Fleet Street hack, to look at what's going on. And here's your story. Go out and do your Google research. And lo and behold, we have the leader of, or at least one of the leaders of the consultants, the non-junior doctors being targeted by the Daily Mail. And we're told that Mike Henley, he's a greedy sod because not only does he work for the NHS, he also works for insurance companies, seven insurance companies. I presume this is when you make a claim that, you know, on your, you know, you've had a traffic accident or you've fallen down the stairs or whatever it is, and you've claimed lots and lots of money and the insurance company arranges a doctor's interview. Well, here's your man. And apparently he charges £2,000 for a consultation. And as I say, according to the Daily Mail, this is outrageous. But anyway, cut the long story short, what's happened with waiting lists in Britain is instead of going down as you would have expected post COVID, they've actually gone up to record levels. And the government's answer isn't to settle with the BMA, neither with the junior doctors or the consultants, but instead, and this has a certain irony to it, of what they're doing is relaxing the rules. This is what they're proposing to do, relaxing the rules when it comes to private companies tendering for NHS contracts. So at the moment, at various levels in the NHS, they have a situation where they have bidding going on. NHS can bid, private companies can bid. Either way, they're going to encourage more companies, private companies, to come in. And of course, the irony, as I was referring to, is of course you're still going to have the same damn doctors, you know, doing your eye operation, fixing your leg, you know, looking at your poor bloody broken head or whatever the hell it happens to be, except they are going to be on a higher salary than in the NHS. And the added bonus for the government is that within these private companies, you ain't allowed to strike alongside your BMA colleagues or your RCN colleagues or your Unison colleagues. And again, another irony, very expected, I have to say, is that Wes Streeting, the shadow Labour Minister of Health, when he's asked about an increasing role for the private sector in the NHS, he says, well, under a Labour government, we indeed would also encourage the private sector to play its role. And of course, he's encouraged in that by Margaret Thatcher's greatest success. And her greatest success, of course, is Tony Blair, the Thatcherite Labour Prime Minister. And I just think it is worthwhile thinking back to Thatcher, because this is actually the Tories, how should you put it, hidden plan, secret plan. Because if you think about Thatcher, she lauded the private sector, you know, as far superior to the public sector. And this was the period of Bupa and how everyone boasted about how marvellous Bupa was. This is a private medical company. But now, of course, the Tories have to do that by stealth. They don't openly proclaim their opposition to the National Health Service. So they have the same agenda as Margaret Thatcher, to shift us over to a private National Health Service. But it's being done by stealth. Now, just a quick comment. Again, my knowledge is limited, but my understanding is in the United States, the health service is fantastic if you've got full medical insurance, which will cost you, depending on how old you are and how healthy you are or how unhealthy you are, an arm and a leg. So, you know, this is slightly an apocryphal story, but, you know, you go in and you've broken your toenail and they'll test you for HIV, hepatitis B, heart condition, and all the rest of it, because they'll notch it up on insurance cover. On the other hand, if you're poor, then it's a different question. Or if your insurance runs out, that's a different question. But what we do know is Americans have to pay twice as much when it comes to their health than British people do. British people pay through taxes, Americans pay through insurance. So the idea that in an insurance system, a private system, is so much more effective, I think is a myth. And the danger is precisely what you can get with medical conditions is you don't just have a broken toenail, you can also get transmittable diseases that can actually affect the whole population. So I'm reminded, you know, in terms of recent news, of the huge scandal that there is in Britain over infected blood products. And this is for haemophiliacs, people just having an operation and the like, who caught hepatitis, HIV, when American blood was imported to cover a shortfall in Britain. Why was this blood infected? Well, because poor people in America, very poor people, sell their blood in order to, keep body and soul together. In Britain, it's the voluntary principle. People give blood because they want to help out others. In America, they give blood because they need the dollar. And in that sense, thousands of people, we don't know how many, were infected by blood coming in from the United States. Anyway, just as an illustration, in terms of nearer home, what privatization results in, all we need to do is think about is dentistry. When I was a kid, dentistry was on the National Health Service. Sometimes I didn't trust dentists. You know, are they drilling my teeth because they need to be drilled, or are they drilling my teeth because they can get money from the National Health Service? I still don't know, except what I do know is nowadays what dentists do is all filmed. It's all on video, and I presume government and insurance agencies check up what they're doing. Either way, we've just had pictures in the media of an NHS, they're very rare now, dentist opening up a list somewhere up north. I don't know where it was. I just looked at the picture. Maybe it was in Hull. Maybe it was, in Huddersfield. I don't know. Either way, what we had is people queuing overnight in order to get onto those lists, because what's happened is the National Health Service, when it comes to dentistry, has died. I know that in terms of my own area, my ex-national health doctor, dentist, I had my mouth open. I think he was doing something or other. And he said, Jack, by the way, you know that we've gone private, don't you? And that's true in London. That's true throughout Britain. And as a result of that, I know from my own dentist, who's got a flash operation. He actually does, voluntary work in North London in a working class area called Tottenham. And he says, well, look, in, the normal patients I have, they've all got all their teeth. Hardly any of them have got fillings. None of them, have got severe problems. They're all, with a good bit of luck, keep their teeth until they die. On the other hand, Jack, when I go to Tottenham, I get them to open their mouths and I'm just horrified, and I'm doing a rescue job. And indeed, so desperate have people got in Britain. There are more and more cases of being reported of people doing dental treatment on themselves, using a pair of pliers to rip out a rotten teeth. And, kids, we've had kids waiting years with rotting teeth before they get treated. This is private medicine for you at the worst, because if you can't afford it, what the hell do you do? If you can't afford the insurance, what do you do? Your teeth rot. And that is something that the Tories have delivered when it comes to dentistry. That is something they would deliver when it comes to the health service. But with this warning, we had a good article in this week's paper about clean air and clean water. And the thing about diseases is they don't just affect poor people. They can affect rich people. If they're transmittable, they can affect rich people. So if poor people start going down with some horrible disease that comes back, some Victorian disease, it's not inconceivable that this could affect even rich people. So National Health Service is something that there ought to be social solidarity about, that even rich people cannot escape certain diseases, as we saw, for example, with the COVID pandemic. Even Boris Johnson went down with it. Okay, I have to do it. I'm doing it almost every single week now. So I know comrades out there will go, yeah, he said that last week, the week before, the week before, but yet another temperature record has been reached. This time it's the surface temperature of the oceans, of the seas. It's pretty factional, but it's the line of travel that's significant here, as always. So what we have, these are global figures, remember. What we have is the announcement, and this will be for July, and that's significant, by the way, that average temperatures were 20.96 degrees centigrade. Now, the previous record was 20.96. Now, if you were how should I put it, a climate skeptic, you go, well, what's the relevance of a 0.01 increase? Well, I'll tell you this. What the Copernicus, this is the EU's climate institute, tell us is that this is not only a record compared with 2016, but this record comes when we would expect, how should I put it, sea temperatures to be actually lower, because apparently sea temperatures are at their highest in March, not, for example, in August. So I know we haven't reached August yet, but it's March that you reach the highest level. And they've got figures, how accurate they are, I don't know, but they have figures because of global shipping that go back 150 years. And so what they tell us, this is the Copernicus Institute, that since 150 years ago, global surface temperatures of the ocean have gone up 0.9 degrees centigrade. And the significance is that over the last 40 years, 0.6 degrees of that is over the last 40 years. That's the point. So in other words, if we look at 150 years ago, sea temperatures were, roughly speaking, as a throwaway figure, 1 degree centigrade lower, but the line of travel is increasingly rapid and is going up. Now, part of that is accounted by this by this El Nino effect, where warm water comes up from lower depths, but it isn't the major factor here. Once again, the major factor, according to the Copernicus Institute, is human, and I should really say capitalist, emissions, you know, from industrial activity, from car activity, from air flights, from heating, and all the rest of it. Meanwhile, we have, before he went, jetted off on his Californian holiday, we had Rishi Sunak using, you know, a visit to Scotland to announce 100 new oil concessions. I won't go into, you know, the fact, as I understand it, that he and his family, in terms of their huge wealth, you know, bought oil shares. Of course, he's got nothing to do with that. He's completely separated from those finances. But no, the real question is that what we have is, how should I put it, an example, I suppose, of fiddling while Rome burns. And what we have is various ministers going on the media telling us that this is British oil for British workers, for British jobs. And of course, we've even had the suggestion that you get out North Sea oil, and that will save on CO2 miles when it comes to delivery, because the idea that this North Sea oil, of course, is only going to be delivered to Britain. Well, we all know that what we're dealing with is a world commodity, a global commodity, and that this commodity that's drilled out of the North Sea could just as easily go to Japan or China or wherever, you know, as compared with Britain. No, what this is about is a criminally irresponsible Tory government that, yeah, is much more interested in profits for the oil majors and speculators than it is in terms of climate security, which, of course, is a global concern. But again, another one of these things that eventually even the super rich, unless they go off and rocket to Mars, that it's eventually even going to affect them. There is no escape at the end of the day. Okay. Penultimately, last question, 5-4-1. I just thought I'd bung in Ukraine. We have drone exchange warfare, which has a marginal, very marginal effect when it comes to the battlefield. Okay, so a Ukrainian drone, and these are meant to be Ukrainian drones, as opposed to American drones, hits a Russian oil tanker in the Black Sea. A Ukrainian drone, and it's again a Ukrainian one, hits Moscow. Meanwhile, Russia hits with either Iranian drones or Russian drones, hits Kiev or some other Ukrainian city or for the front line. But this isn't going to fundamentally alter the battlefield. The battlefield, in my view, looks like, unless there's big political developments, to be a stalemate. Something dramatic could happen, like the election of Donald Trump, the overthrow of Vladimir Putin. You know, all of those are possibilities. But at the moment, in spite of the fury of Wagner and Prezetskin, you know, about the Russian high command, actually, what they've done militarily, if they don't want to conquer Ukraine, but if they want to keep what they've got, has been the sensible thing and the very militarily effective thing, and that is dig, dig, dig. And they've put in very sophisticated and interconnected lines of trenches. They put in line after line of these dragon's teeth. They put in tank traps, and they've laid apparently huge, huge and very dense minefields. The most ridiculous explanation I've read when it comes to the complete lack of success, and it is complete. I mean, a village here, a little advance there, but no, the so-called spring offensive not only waited just before the end of spring, but it's got absolutely nowhere. It began as a whimper, has continued as a whimper in spite of all these, you know, Challenger 2 tanks, Leopard tanks, Abraham tanks on the way, blah, 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 Bradley fighting vehicles. They've got nowhere. And as I said, the most risible explanation has come from the British Ministry of Defence, you know, Ben Wallace and all the rest of it. Apparently, because, you know, this land is normally full of wheat or something like that, it's normally farmland. And given, you know, the fighting, there hasn't been a harvest, no planting done, that instead we got vegetation. This is just bollocks, if you excuse the language. You know, the idea that with cover, the Ukrainian forces don't actually have an advantage when they're attacking lines of trenches is ridiculous. No, but what they're finding in the midst of this undergrowth that apparently is springing up, of course, is mines. And meanwhile, as they advance, they're advancing into, killing zones from specially protected artillery. And they're being done from the air by drones. And apparently, and this is interesting, they're also being done very effectively by attack helicopters, which previously were very vulnerable to being shot down by surface-to-air missiles, not least, you know, shoulder-launched missiles. So that's the situation militarily. And I wouldn't have been surprised that if Ukraine had, for example, recaptured Bakhmut, because that had just been taken by Wagner, no deep trenches. Okay, it's an urban area and that's very difficult to fight, but no significant advance in or around Bakhmut. Quite the opposite, we've seen again stalemate. And by the way, a footnote there, the idea that Bakhmut was a strategic asset to gain on either side, bollocks again. You know, Wagner took it, Russia then didn't, then advance all the way to Kiev, didn't advance an inch having taken it. No, they waited for the Ukrainians to come, and the Ukrainians have made no advance, as far as I know. There's been no celebration. Okay, so we then shift to diplomacy, and what we have is, without Russia, a meeting in Saudi Arabia, presumably presided over by MBS, a sort of off-on now ally of the United States. Who knows what exactly the relationship is? He's clearly got ambitions, you know, of the big time. I think he will experience hubris before long. Either way, we have at least the possibility, because of the stalemate when it comes to the battlefield, of things shifting to diplomacy. At the moment, Ukraine is saying they want everything back, but if they don't make progress on the battlefield, well, what do? You carry on with one of these forever wars. That's quite conceivable. But again, there are big political developments that are going to happen that will take us all by surprise. Lastly, and leastly, what's it called? Transform. This is left unity, from what I can see. Reborn. Hurrah. Well, quite frankly, we've been in respect. That was dreadful. It's Popular Front with the SWP, whatever they call themselves, socialist resistance or resisting socialism. You know, Nick Rack, George Galloway, and the Muslim Brotherhood, i.e. the MAB, Muslim Association of Britain. That was awful. You know, we had in that organization, the SWP, when we presented them with their own What We Stand For column, you know, we stand for international socialism, they voted it down. We even had a situation of where we put forth the idea that respect should stand for republicanism. We had an SWP speaker at their conference, this is all conference stuff, get up and explain to us, well, if you stand for republicanism, that would put off royalists. And we're going, well, yeah, a bit like if you stand for socialism, I suppose that would put off anti-socialists, yeah. We even had them in the situation where we put forward the idea of a woman's right to choose whether or not to have an abortion. They voted that down, and instead voted for a woman's right to choose, which apparently is the right to choose whether or not to wear a headscarf. Well, I'm in favor of that. I'm in favor of that. But the idea that the SWP, you know, votes down fundamental should have caused a rebellion in their ranks. It didn't. It didn't cause a whimper, apart from Chris Harman, as far as I can see, who penned some sort of Aesopian, let's get the right word, after Aesop's Tales, you know, polemic, I think, in international socialism. But left unity was worse than that. They were absolutely obsessed with safe spaces. They wanted a situation, thanks to us, by the way, we made sure that there wasn't sufficient votes. You had to have, a three-quarters majority to get through things like, if a young person joined left unity, they were going to be given a chaperone to make sure that they weren't sexually molested. Well, personally, you know, if I was under 21, or if I was 18 or 16, we had comrades, you know, I think who are younger than that in left unity. If somebody approached me and said, oh, by the way, I've been appointed as your chaperone, I'd run from them. But they were obsessed, you know, with so-called political correctness, to the point where we had Liz Davis, former Labour candidate up in Leeds, she had the bright idea of banning heckling. We innocently pointed out the origins of heckling. Apparently it's Dundee workers in the jute mills with the noise going on. And what would happen in the 19th century is somebody called the heckler would read the radical newspapers out loud and shouting so that the workforce got the latest news about Chartism or the trade union movement or the socialist movement. That's the origin of the word heckle. And we gave them examples of, you know, the civil rights movement, the Bolshevik congresses where Lenin was heckled and answered Bukharin, and how heckling was a healthy and democratic institution. Anyway, we lost the vote. And I can always remember just getting up, having lost the vote on a separate subject. I get up on behalf of the Communist Platform, and Liz Bloody Davis is heckling me. You know, just passed this ridiculous rule banning heckling. So good luck to them. All I would say to them is that look at your platform that you founded yourself on. We're in the middle of a NATO proxy war. You know, that has eerie reminiscences in that sense of World War One. No, the numbers dying aren't the same, but we have Ukraine playing the role of Belgium, of Serbia, and we have too many ex-comrades on the left going over to social imperialism. So in my understanding, it isn't just the AWL and sections of the Labour left. That's predictable. But as I understand it, the latest to fall in line, I could be wrong and I'd love to be corrected, is workers' power. Workers' power has decided that what Ukraine is all about is a battle for self-determination, as if World War One was a battle for the right of Belgium to self-determination. No, it wasn't. It's a clash between great powers. And we can argue about whether Russia is imperialist or not. It doesn't matter. What matters is our own imperialist power. And the main enemy is at home. I've been talking about Rishi Sunak. I've been talking about Keir Starmer. I've been talking about Wes Streeting, the National Health Service, the NHS. These people attacking our health, our democratic rights to demonstrate, to publish, to speak, are the same people that are lined up on behalf of Zelensky and the Azov Brigade in Ukraine. That doesn't make me a defender of Putin or Russia. Anyway, the very fact that Transform doesn't mention Ukraine shows its true worth. It is worthless. And if they are avoiding mentioning it because they think it would split them early, well then, comrades, it will split you later. You cannot avoid high politics. Thank you, Kevin.